Welcome to the Water Entrepreneur Podcast. This program features a series of interviews exploring the origin stories of startup founders, early adopters, and innovation champions related to their personal, technical, business, organizational, and financial journeys. This podcast is sponsored by Astera, the leader in remote Earth observation technology for the water industry. Support is also supplied by Imagine H2O, envisioning and building solutions with the world's best water entrepreneurs, and Aquarius Spectrum, providing advanced fixed-base leak detection solutions to the water utility business. And now, live from beautiful downtown Encinitas, your host, Paul Gagliardo. Welcome and thanks for joining me today. This is episode 21 of the Water Entrepreneur Podcast, and I'm your host, Paul Gagliardo. And today, I'm really excited to have as my guests, Greg Quist and David Drake. Greg is co-founder, president, and CEO, and David is a co-founder and now on the board of directors of SmartCover, offering cost-effective satellite manhole monitoring solutions to eliminate sewer overflows, optimize collection system cleaning, and accurately identify INI. Hey, Greg, David, thanks for being a water entrepreneur and appearing on the show today.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, Paul. Nice to be here. Just want to correct one thing off the bat, though.
I'm
no longer the CEO. We've hired a professional to do that job, Corey Williams.
Okay. Well, you better update your LinkedIn profile then. I noticed one of you has a space picture in the back and the other one has a rubber dinghy in the back. So, you know, I think we got everything covered from, you know, the mountains to the moon mountains, I guess, right? Well, it's good to see you guys. So this is my first time interviewing a tag team. I hope it goes smoothly. You know, being aware of what is going on underground in our buried assets is critical to maintaining them, ensuring proper operation, and avoiding regulatory noncompliance. Wastewater systems have natural access points and are unpressurized systems. Manholes are spaced every 100 meters or so, which makes a much easier system to monitor than potable water systems. How did you guys come up with the idea of providing monitoring solutions on the underside of a manhole cover?
So, Paul, let me start by picking up a little bit of the history of all this. Dave and I met on the County Water Authority Board of Directors back in 2006, and we did some businesses together that we don't have time to discuss today. But when one of those rolled up, we were literally sitting around his living room and decided to call three of our friends that were in the water business, thinking that the water business is kind of the 1950s and 1960s. It needs to be updated to the 21st century or 20th century at that point. We called three of our friends and said, "What keeps you up at night?" And Dave and I were expecting some kind of technical solution, being technologists, you know, something like fleet optimization or bacteria detection or something like that. And instead, the answer we got was sewer spills. So we both kind of looked at each other going, "Sewer spills? What do we do about sewer spills?" So we jumped on the internet. It was on the internet at that point in 2005 and looked around. And in the U.S. Patent Office, there was nobody that had patented anything regarding monitoring sewers and overflows. And we looked also to find out if anybody was doing it, and they weren't. So then we turned back to those guys and we said, "Hey, what do you want? We've got a blank sheet of paper. Dave and I are technologists. We both do systems integration, and we'd like to try to help you guys." So we never walked into this with our own answer. What we did is we asked them, "You tell us what you want." And basically they said, "We want to have our sewers monitored and tell us beforehand if we're going to have an overflow or not. And you guys should be able to do that kind of thing. So keep the stuff out of the water, make it easy to install, make it affordable to operate, and I'm good to go." And that's how the whole thing started.
Interesting. So with the solution, tell me what kind of sensors you deploy, what kind of data you collect, what are the kinds of things you look for? I mean, do you need like a a light for your camera so you can see what's going on underground? You know, give me a little explanation.
It's an interesting question. What we were trying to do was the first problem we were trying to face was just where is the water level? And both Greg and I had some experience at sensors and with two-way paging, which turned out to be our first communications choice. But it turned out that ultrasonic sensing of the water level was probably the best way to go. There were other things we could look at, but one thing you really have to realize in a sewer is you have very corrosive gases. And if you try to do anything optical, it's extremely difficult. Doable, but it takes a lot of labor. So one of the issues we wanted to face was, could we make a solution that fundamentally did not require a lot of labor, did not require a lot of installation time, was also relatively inexpensive to develop, so we could pay for the development out of our own pockets. And so there were some constraints to the process to make it work, but we were very lucky in that we both understood how two-way paging worked. And at the time, 2005, that was a big deal. There was a lot of two-way paging in the world, and we were able to deploy based on that. So now the question is, how do you combine the sensors, some computer technology, and the communications to make a system? We also decided that we really needed to have it be two-way. We wanted to be able to send commands to it as well as return data back. So there were several key technical drivers that kind of forced us into the way we did it. So that's kind of what made it all go. But we also started with a particular type of ultrasonic sensor, which turned out to be abysmal. And we got very lucky. We went to a meeting up in Sacramento and ran across the sensor that we used for about the next 15 years. And so it was a very interesting series of steps to get to the right sensor. But we were very lucky to get one early enough that it worked. It required some modification, which was good, because if it's modified, it kind of becomes our IP. So there were a lot of, again, steps we took. And believe me, no one, we didn't sit down there and plan it. We discovered it sort of day by day.
So besides the one thing is that we were looking to fail fast, right? And yes. Like David said, we tried a lot of stuff early.
Yeah.
Because we had friends in the industry that would let us play around in their sewer systems. We were able to make mistakes and learn from those things. We started in February of 2005. And by November of 2005, January 2006, we actually sold our first units, which was a complete, at that point, an Internet of Things solution before Internet of Things was even a phrase.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, somebody has to lead the way, right? So I'm glad it was you guys. So besides the
thing that kind of led the way was the fact that we had imputed trust. We had guys that knew us and knew that we weren't scam artists, and we weren't trying to sell them a widget. We were trying to get to a solution, and they understood that.
So besides the water level sensor, what other kinds of sensor packages do you have?
Well, one primary thing we realized, we had the opportunity, because of the speed of the systems, that if somebody lifted the manhole cover, it could be an alarm. And so that became a valuable part of the enterprise. We started with tilt switches. We eventually moved on to MIM switches. But the tilt detector was actually a very valuable feature. And we didn't realize how important it would be. More recently, we also added pressure sensors for water pressure, for things like force mains, and also being underneath the water, we could measure how far we were down. And then also in the last couple of years, we've added hydrogen sulfide sensing, which we realized was right in the same wheelhouse with what our existing customers were doing. And it could really affect how systems corrode, as well as the political problem of odors, where people call the mayor and say, "Mayor, it happened again." So we saw an opportunity with the same community.
And you talk about I&I. I guess maybe my question more is around the analytics of the data. So, you know, you're not just a hardware company, you're providing software and analytics too. So tell me some of the analytical packages you've got going on.
Well, one of the key things we did was to recognize that there were other sources of data, in particular NOAA, the oceanographic guys, and other places like the USGS.
USGS, yep.
Yeah, had stream measurements already. So we were able to take and use the APIs, the application interface context for those, to grab their data, in particular for rain. And we hooked up with a company that does rain detection and cleaning up of the rain data. And so we hit them with rain requests all the time. And so we could correlate rain with what's going on in the sewer. And so if we saw that correlation, we do that with a cross-correlation function. If it hits above a threshold, we say, hey, that is a site where there's real I&I. And that was how that analytic works. And that's been tremendously successful.
That's interesting. Yeah, I like, I'm really interested when people develop a product or a service, and then, you know, they understand that you can add in other data.
Absolutely.
To make it more robust, provide better, more actionable knowledge for the customer. You know, it just adds a lot of value to the customer when you can leverage things that some of the other folks are doing.
That's
a great example of that, Paul, is something we call Smart Clean, which is where, you know, because we can measure the water level continuously and we get historical data and it comes in real time, we can see how things change over time. And one of the things that sort of surprised us, and frankly, our customers as well, is once these sensors were out there, seeing stuff they had never imagined before. And one example of that was a system we had up in Hawthorne. Early on, when we were a relatively young company. They were one of our first large customers. We had a unit in an area actually where Marilyn Monroe grew up, and we were watching this system, and we were getting these alarms that happened about 4 or 5 o'clock every afternoon. So we immediately thought it was our fault, because we were always assuming that, you know, if there's a mistake, it's our fault. So we did some investigation, and the odd thing was it was happening at the same time every day, because by the time the guys went out there and checked, they could go look and, oh, the water looks fine. I don't know what's going on. It was just a peak that went up and went back down. Didn't happen on Saturdays and Sundays. It only happened during the week. So the guy that ran the system decided he was going to go check it out. So he went downstream and found out that the guys were dumping their kiddie pool into the sewer every day at the end of the day, and that water was washing up, creating a spike, and then going back down again. So these are the kind of things that, without the visibility into their system, they'd have no idea what was going on. So that's an interesting part, as you see these things happening. Relative to Smart Clean, because we can see the patterns in the water, we can see those patterns change over time, and those patterns will reflect what's happening, what's going downstream or upstream from the site that we're looking at. And that will enable our customers to proactively clean their system, as opposed to doing it on a schedule, which is a very important aspect. Saves them a lot of money. Trucks aren't rolling for no reason. And that works out very well.
Paul, you said a key thing about the strategy. One of the things we bring our clients is the ability to have closed loop control. In the past, the way they found a sewer spill was that somebody would call them up and say, hey, there's some mess in the street. What's going on? Now they can see it themselves, get it ahead of time, and mitigate it before it becomes a disaster. So we're moving people from open loop to closed loop control.
How did you know, once you put in a system like this, it, even if the client thinks it's going to be useful, somebody still has to be, I don't want to say trained, but educated to understand what things mean, and then to be proactive and take action. Did you find that, I mean, you're probably selling to a certain person and then somebody else that actually has to run it or use it. Do you find that there was any kind of disconnect between the people that were procuring the solution and the people that actually had to operate the solution or use it?
Dave, I'll take that one again. You can fill it in if you like. We started by building our system so that the guys at the startup level of the system, the guys in the street, could use it very easily. So we built it so it effectively needed no training and no special education or technology to do it. And because of that, they liked it. They were the guys that had to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning when somebody called and said, there's sewage running down my street. So that's how we started, actually, was selling to the folks that were actually operating it. So one of our challenges, frankly, has been to get to the higher levels to give the management and the owners of the systems the strategic view to say, hey, not am I only fixing a couple of these spots where I have Band-Aids, but I have a systematic solution now for my whole system. Dave, you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, well said. And one of the other interesting issues is when we were early on, no one had really heard of us. And so if the senior manager bought it for the lower supervisors, they said, well, what's this? Is it going to take my job? Now they realize how important it is and how much value there is to it. So rather than selling at the floor, we can sell at either level, and it's accepted by both parties. So but that very high top-down sale is where you get the 50 and 100 unit sales. The bottom sales tend to be small handfuls because they have to do a lot of internal selling themselves to get the funding for it. So the big systems come top-down.
Have you installed any product on systems that are CSOs? You know, because you have that additional issue of the storm drain, you know, coming in, stormwater coming into the sewer lines. Is that a big application that you guys have?
That's a great question, Paul. We got quite a lot of these in the Northeast. A lot of folks there are actually being required from a regulatory standpoint to report when a spill starts, when it stops, and how much sewage got into the streams and rivers and that sort of thing. So we're very actively helping people in the CSO world. Our system sits back behind like an overflow weir, monitors what we call the wet side, which is where the water in the sewage is going normally. And then when a storm comes, we can see the water go over the weir, measure how much is going over, tell them start, stop, and how much went over. One of our customers in New York, for example, Newburgh on the Hudson River, told us that every time that they use our system, we save them 2 weeks worth of labor instead of writing the reports. They just send that data to the state and they're happy.
Greg's absolutely right. And the CSO issue is so serious. I mean, people would do crazy things to try to measure when they had a CSO, like a block of wood on a string. So if they had a CSO, that's what they measure. Well, let's put it this way. We improve that data acquisition process. But CSOs are a major part. What Greg just did, by the way, was to describe one of our patents. We have a dozen patents. So one of the things we did when we formed the company, Greg kind of focused on patents. I focused on trademarks. And we did a very broad, very deep set of intellectual property that we knew would become part of the value of the company. Without that, people say, oh, you don't have any patents or trademarks. Of course, if you have patents and trademarks, they go, oh, they're not that important. But if you have them, you go, okay, we're all right.
it's so interesting because most of the founders, the startup founders I interview are young and don't have a lot of experience. And almost, I'd say 90% or more, don't even have anybody on their team that has any water experience. So it's really fascinating to talk to startup founders that have a lot of water experience and just have a lot of experience in general. And, you know, just this whole idea about, you know, the concept of IP and, you know, if you have it, people like, who cares? If you don't have it, people like, wow, you know, you got to have it.
It's just not fair.
you got to make sure you've got it all. And so if they say we don't care, it's like, fine. Somebody will care, right? You were both elected members of a water board. My father was on school boards, back when I was a kid. And it was always fascinating to watch him play politician, if I can use a polite way of saying it. What was your experience like being elected official, being on a board, sitting in the big chair behind the big desk?
Well, let me start. I just got reelected, Paul, as a matter of fact.
So, well, congratulations. High five.
I'm very, very thankful for that. I think relative to this discussion in terms of our company, I believe it did a couple of things. First of all, it gave David and I a real feeling for what the ethic in the water business is. I think 99.9% of the people that are in the water industry are there not only because they get paid for it, but because they're doing something good for humanity. Yeah. And I think that we have absorbed that to a certain extent. Hopefully we had some of that beforehand, but because we've been in the water industry for quite a while, I think we've absorbed that. So we understand how people think about things. Including how do I solve a problem? How do I go about procuring things? How do I do things differently? And that understanding, I think, has been helpful for us in terms of getting the business going. The second thing on the flip side, like David mentioned earlier, is people trusted us because they knew us. They knew that we're in this for the long haul. We're not going to come in and make a bunch of money and get out. That's not what we're doing. We're actually here to help the industry move forward in our way that we can help in our little corner of the world, help things move forward. Dave?
Absolutely true. You get perspective behind the big desk. You also get a sense of money management, where the costs really are. I also sit on the Joint Powers Insurance Authority Board. I'm the vice president of the JPIA. And you can really see what happens when things go badly and how much money it costs to fix a sewer-filled basement. So you learn about, holy cow, the impact of it, which sometimes people don't want to talk about. The impact could be very severe. And so that helped us in terms of being able to sharpen our message and be able to be more direct about the problem.
It's interesting when I left the city of San Diego, when I left American Water, people would come to me and say, hey, oh, you know, all those people over there, you can get me in, you know, you can introduce me, blah, blah, blah. And I quickly realized that after I left, they didn't want to have anything to do with me. They were like, you know,
they're busy.
They're busy. They got stuff to do. And especially, you know, because I was more in the consulting side of things, you know, trying to sell that as opposed to products. But I find that it's interesting that the way you guys, you know, kind of attack creating this business was to talk to the customer first. Find out what the voice of the customer was. What do they want? What are they looking for? So that, you know, when you did have something, it's like, hey, you said you wanted this, you know, now I got it, you know, so, you know, let's go on from there. But yeah, I always felt a little, I thought, great. Oh, you know, I'll be welcomed back with open arms. Nah, they lock the doors and, you know, change their phone numbers.
if I had a nickel for every time somebody told me, because in the early days, I did a lot of the installations, I'd go out there and the guys in the field would say, you know, I thought of that before. And, you know, I heard that a lot in the beginning. We don't hear much anymore, but that's back in the early days when they thought about it. But we actually did it. So that was kind of neat.
Absolutely true. I was giving an event up in Huntington Beach at the library up there. And two guys saw our stuff and they said, we invented that. I think one of the key things that these guys would think about is making the measurement. The hardest part was communications. And so we went through a couple of different rounds and generations of communication to finally end up where we are with the Iridium satellite system. And that turned out to be a tremendous win. We took a risk. The prices went up, but the functionality exploded. So it was an enormous improvement in how we were doing things. So it's again, the things you don't plan it, you discover it.
And do you have antennas like in the manhole, or is everything underneath?
No, the most of them are on top. With two different kinds of structures of antennas, some for designed for areas that have snow plows, it would take them right off, and others for areas like here that don't have snow. But also under a composite cover, we can actually put the antenna underneath. We can also actually remote the antenna if we have to, if there are reasons to do that. But there really is an antenna you can see, so that is there.
And Paul, one of the reasons our product is called Smart Cover, and it differentiates us from most of the other SCADA stuff, is our system out there actually does a lot of its own in situ analysis. So there's coding that goes on in each individual unit that's out there in the field. So before it sends data back, it decides what good data is before it sends it back. So we can minimize the bandwidth. A lot of other sensors are what I call dumb sensors. They just plow the information back up and all the analysis happens on the server. But the advantage of that, of course, is that we can be very judicious about how much we use. And that's why satellites work quite well for us.
Keeps the bandwidth down.
And go ahead.
I just said that's an important part of making a successful product, really.
So I was curious about kind of battery life and, you know, if you have interchangeable batteries or not, because if you're doing computing, you know, at the point of installation, I don't know if that takes more power or if backhauling the data takes more power.
It's actually a very important issue. And when we started out, our first systems had a relatively short battery life of relatively small batteries. And so what happened over time was we increased the battery size, changed the mounting structure, but vastly reduced the consumption of power over time. And we had actually a very key part of a discovery that we made after the first roughly 8 or 9 months of service, where there was a particular piece of firmware code that by its nature consumed about 3 or 4 times more power than it had to. And I actually put a note in the code that there says, this change saves us $100,000 a year. You do find those things. But now we go years. It's astonishing that we do the data acquisition every 10 minutes. We are doing data transmission for years on a set of batteries directed to outer space. It's an astonishing process. And the guys that took over for us have done a much better job and are adding intrinsic safety. So there's a lot of things that are important to how the product works.
Tell me some of the things, I mean, you've kind of touched on some of them, but maybe more from, I don't know, the business side, or the recruiting of talent side and hiring of people side, things that can, you know, that surprised you about starting up a little company?
Go ahead, Greg.
Well, in terms of the business side, because we kind of started small and literally in David's garage, we were able to self-finance for quite a while. Then we had to go out to the marketplace, obviously, as we grew. About a couple of years later, we needed customer service people, we needed salespeople and all that sort of thing. We tended to look at folks that had some water industry experience, again, because they shared the ethic that we had. Some of those worked and some of those didn't. But as we've gotten older, we've gotten better. In 2006, we had a partner join us, XPV Water Partners. They've been a fantastic partner. They understand the industry. They understand how fast things move or don't move. They understand the ethic. So we share a lot of things together. So they've been a phenomenal partner. They've also helped us in terms of hiring good talent. And we've done a very good job of doing that. I think most recently, the hardest part right now is finding kind of the production level people. And I think this is sort of a pandemic hangover. It's been hard for people to come and go and keep a long-term job at that level. Our senior level folks are top notch. I think it's a world-class team. And I think it was built because of people like XPV that they could partner with us. The problem, like I said, we're having is the folks at the kind of entry level that come and go quite quickly. And I that's probably a social, you know, thing that we could talk about offline, but very difficult. Dave?
Yeah, just if we were the smart cover of a few years ago trying to compete with us now, we'd never compete. We'd become extremely strong. And if you look at the resumes of the people we got tremendously valuable people, very capable, lots of local knowledge, lots of industry knowledge. I'm astonished at how good the folks have got. It's funny, you're looking at the total population of the company back in 2005, and now we've got approaching 60 people in the company.
Oh, so wow.
It's been a big growth spurt. And as what we've been told by our good friends at XPV is it looks like we now have probably the largest market share of this entire industry. And we are beating companies many times our size.
So, I know the guys at XPV quite well. I'm curious. I used to work with Khalil when he was at Xenon. I go, you know, pre-XPV with those guys. They were, I worked a lot with them at American Water, you know, when they first started. But one of the things I was going to ask you about is I know XPV usually likes to invest in companies and then roll them into some of their other portfolio companies. Have they let you stay on your own, or maybe not let you, but has that been the experience from your side? And I'm just curious because I know that is commonplace for XPV.
It is commonplace, and I think they see us as having a very long runway and a lot of greenfield, even though we are growing like crazy and being very successful in doing that. We're balancing the operations and production issues that are associated with fast growth, as well as gaining the fast growth. I think they see us as still only at the tip of the iceberg of this particular market. So we're pretty excited about what our future has, and so far so good in terms of that. So I don't see anything happening in terms of any near-term roll-ups.
I agree. I think that the roll-ups that we might be interested in are, there are some potential vendors who we buy from, and the roll-up might be more vertical to reach them than horizontal to collaborate. So it's a slightly different direction of what might roll up.
And do you guys do all your manufacturing and production in-house, or I mean, in the U.S., or are you buying product and just fabricating? How are you guys handling that side?
So it's a hybrid, Paul, between buying parts from vendors, kind of white label, and also doing some internal stuff. And we're working on kind of streamlining that system now as we get bigger. Our production capability is quite large, and we haven't even reached that yet. So we're building to look. You know, we're anticipating what's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years in terms of what our requirements are going to be. And I think, you know, we're happy with our vendors. They've done a really good job. Yes. We work very closely with them. Again, we share the same kind of business ethic and requirements that they have.
I got to tell you, one of the things that has always amazed me is the support we got from our vendors and our clients at both ends of the pipe. People want us to succeed, and that is absolutely heartwarming. And people have bent over backwards, given us test labor, given us support of all kinds. And that's been an amazing process. So we try to pay back where we can. And even our clients are the same way. There's a sense of mutual teamwork that is extremely powerful. The one thing that has affected us, like everybody else, is the supply chain issue. And so one of the things we've had to do in the last few months is advance ahead, buy more material to get it in-house. And that's been a challenge, but we've met the challenge. And so far, so good. We're still shipping like crazy.
Great. That's terrific. So what advice would you give to somebody who's considering starting a water-focused startup company? You got any sage advice for the listeners?
The sage advice I'd give is do your marketing research very, very carefully. I won't name any names, but Greg and I worked on a previous product, and it turned out that the people that wanted to buy it maybe wanted to buy one and keep it in the back room and not tell anybody about it. It was almost a secret product. So what we lucked into, I don't think we really planned it. We lucked into a product that they needed to buy dozens of and hundreds of. And so it made it a lot more valuable. The other decision we made, which was done the very first day, is that it had to have a service component. So we'd be selling service forever. And that became one of the key questions later on. They always ask us, well, do you sell service? We sell, heck we do. You're darn right we do. And so the margin on that and the business growth from that is important. So if they're thinking about a water business, think about the aspect of intellectual property, ongoing service support, and making sure that the customer wants to buy lots of them. Those are key elements.
I'd say that one thing that we did from the very beginning, Paul, and I kind of touched on that earlier, is we asked them what keeps them up at night and what problems do they need to have solved.
Yep.
And, a lot of people come up with great widgets that they think are going to, be gangbusters, and it turns out that's not going to work. So I think the reason this one worked was we had a white sheet of paper, and it was their ideas, not ours. And that's really what got us in the right position, I think. So I think if I were to start out from scratch right now, and I wanted to get in the water business, I'd learn about the water business and find out, where is it going? How are things going? What's going on with the labor force? What's happening on their finance side? What are the stressors that's happening in the industry? Is it supply? Is it quality? Is it reliability? What things matter to people? So I'd spend some time learning about it before I jump into it and try to do something hard.
Do you have any plans for new products and services off of the existing platform?
The answer is yes, and we're not going to talk much about those.
That's right.
I thought I had you there. I thought keep talking.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you have plans for the future. I'm always, whenever I ask that question, I'm always think about my mother-in-law, who is now just turned 101. She's farms up in the Central Valley in California. And about when she was 90 or 91, she decided to plant pistachios. Uh-huh. And pistachios take 7 or 8 years before they produce a crop. And we were like, Anna.
Said, Mom, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
Planning for the future.
Planning for the future. And as a good farmer does, they're like, if I'm not here, it's okay. It's the legacy thing. But, she's still here. She's still kicking.
She's still got pistachios, yeah.
Yeah, so it's you always have to have plans. Don't sit on your laurels. You have a good product now, successful, keep thinking about, okay, what's next? And so that's good to hear that you've got some plans.
Again, Paul, we listen to our customers. The whole H2S thing came from our customers.
Oh, yeah.
We measure flow in a lot of cases. That came from our customers. The CSO application came from our customers. So we're continuously talking to them and asking them, what could we do better? What can we do different that would help you out and get you successful? We want them to be successful.
Great. Well, that's if you can provide them things that help them be successful and are a good value proposition, then it's going to go a long way. And you guys are going to be successful as well. So, that was a great conversation. It actually, with the two-headed beast, it actually wasn't too hard. I'm going to have to work on my video editing there.
video. But, now you tell us.
Well, you know, yeah, right. I always got TikTok, man. You know, that's the next, that's the next thing. but I really appreciate you guys joining me. It was a really fun conversation.
Thank you all for listening. This podcast was brought to you by Astera, with additional support from Imagine H2O and Aquarius Spectrum. The producer is Anna Gagliardo. Theme music by Gabriella Gagliardo. Yes, this is a family affair. Your host is Paul Gagliardo. If you have any questions about this podcast or the series, please contact us at thewaterentrepreneur@gmail.com. And please follow us on Instagram. We hope to see you all again next time.